welcome back to HE Podcast, a series where we explore and understand how research works in the environment and ecology and how its implementation can pull us out of climate doom. The HE Podcast is your one-stop shop of curated content on conservation, sustainability, and the environment. This is your host, Namrata Murli. Today, we explore Northeast India with Dr. Sarla Khele, who is joining us all the way from Gangtok. She is the Regional Director of HE's Eastern Himalaya Northeast Regional Office. The work her office is involved in includes biodiversity conservation, ecosystem services for human well-being, human-wildlife interactions, livelihoods, food systems, citizen science-based biodiversity documentation. HE's vision for the region is to secure multifunctional landscapes in Northeast India that protect biodiversity, maintains ecosystems with integrity, and promotes the well-being of its people. Let's hear more about this from Dr. Kaling herself. Welcome, Dr. Kaling, and thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Hi, Namrata. Thank you.
So, Dr. Kaling, could you tell us a little bit about the projects that are going on right now, and what are the projects that excite you the most?
So I think you've already mentioned in the Northeast, we are working on biodiversity conservation. So we have a project that actually works on the socio-ecological landscape. So we are looking at key biodiversity elements that are outside the protected areas, because whenever we say work on biodiversity, a lot of people think it's biodiversity that is retained in the protected areas. But in the mountains here in Sikkim, Darjeeling, and all across the Northeast, we know that there is a lot of biodiversity retained even in our, you know, agroforestry systems, in our agricultural systems, in any of these systems which have been modified by human beings since time immemorial. So we are trying to say that, you know, it's not just the protected areas that are important. We are not comparing which is where it is more or where it is less or whatever, but we are saying that yes, the protected areas do have our, you know, biodiversity, rich biodiversity, but then we shouldn't leave out some of these, you know, socio-ecological systems that also hold a lot of these key biodiversity elements, as well as ecosystem services that cater to the well-being of the people who depend on these ecosystem services as well as the biodiversity. The other project that we are working on is on, you know, critically endangered species. So basically, the pangolins, the Indian pangolin and the Chinese pangolin. We also did some work on some threatened hornbills. And we are also working on the very, very critically endangered white-bellied heron. So the white-bellied heron, as we know, it's only about 200 individuals probably in the wild, in the world, in its global range, which is basically Bhutan, India, and Southeast Asia, Myanmar, and probably in China, we don't know. So we are working on these critically endangered species, but again, not working only from a species perspective. We are also trying to look at the human interactions, you know, wherever these critically endangered species exist, there is a lot of human interactions going on. A lot of people call it threats. I mean, we can call it threats, but again, these, I would like to more call it like interactions, you know. What is driving some of these changes? What is driving some of these habitat changes? What are the socioeconomic factors? Probably some policy factors. What are some, you know, market influences on these habitats? You know, what is the development pathway that is being undertaken in Northeast India by which these animals which are not thought about, these species which are least thought about, are getting impacted? And so we are also working on that. Thirdly, we are also working on sustainable and healthy food systems. We're trying to look at, you know, through a pilot study actually in Sikkim, we are trying to understand how agriculture has changed, you know, how agriculture patterns have changed, and how by changing agriculture patterns, how have the food system changed? So what are the drivers of the changes in these food systems? Is it policy? Is it some government scheme? Are these markets? Are these aspirations? Why is food becoming, taste becoming more homogenized? And why are we losing our food crops, you know? And how can we have a win-win situation where farmers, of course, should grow some of these traditional crops, but also have some kind of an incentive, monetary incentive, because we can't expect everyone to live like they lived 50 years ago. So this is the other one. The fourth thing that we do a lot, and you mentioned, is livelihoods. So livelihoods, basically, when Atri started, we started more like an inputs, you know, giving inputs at the household level. We've moved away a little bit from that. And now we are trying to more work more on enterprise-based livelihoods. So basically, instead of giving out things, why can't we just develop skills, you know, institutions, and do some convergence with ongoing government programs, whereby communities themselves develop these enterprises, and we help them to build the skills, and we help them to build these institutions. So institutions, when I say, it can be self-help groups, it can be cooperatives, and it can be the farmer producer organizations. And what we try to do, and which links to ATRI's work, is that, you know, we try and promote enterprises that are nature-based, so that livelihoods are diversified, but it is nature-based. So things like tourism is one. Agri enterprises is an important thing because it's, again, inextricably linked with nature and biodiversity and ecosystem services. And also some energy-related enterprises, enterprises from invasive species, not at the scale in which ATRI is doing it in South India, but through small, you know, niche-based kind of enterprises for the mountains. So, and yes, citizen science is one thing we are doing. Citizen science is in everything, not only just documenting biodiversity, but we're also trying to use citizen science in terms of, you know, documenting pollinators and reaching out to farmers and saying, know your pollinators, like a campaign that we run. The other one also is like, when we do these biodiversity-based citizen science, it's not just for the sake of documenting species, for the sake of species. For example, if we are documenting butterflies, we talk a lot about, you know, what is it to the farmer? What is it to an agriculturist? Why is it important to them? Why is, you know, documenting butterflies or moths important to a tourism entrepreneur? So we try and link what is the, you know, other than the ecosystem services and the biodiversity kind of values that these species provide, what is it for them, for their lives, for their livelihoods? We try and connect this also. The other thing that we also did is in terms of looking at COVID, during the time of COVID, we also did a lot of these citizen science in terms of documenting the diversity of these nutrition-rich homestead gardens. So we tried to see, you know, how these homestead gardens were contributing to the, you know, diet and nutrition of the people, especially when during the COVID time, when there was lockdown and all the, you know, supply chains were disrupted and, you know, market access was very, very limited. So that's what we've been doing. And then a lot of training that we do, a lot of training for local students, schools, researchers. So these are some, let's say, in gist of the some of the projects that we've been, you know, implementing in Northeast India. What excites me most, like you asked, I think all of it is exciting. I find especially working, because I find myself fortunate in the sense, like I don't have to be a desktop kind of a, you know, environmentalist, so to say, but I am equally linked and connected in the field, because I can go down to the field and see how things are and, you know about these little nuances of implementation. But I also sit in Gangtok and I also know about policies, other programs, and the other level of, you know, what goes on. I can read, I get access to, you know, good, nice literature. I'm part of good groups. So I get both these experiences and I find that very, very exciting. Lately, I think the food work that we are doing, it's really, really exciting, because I think it's everybody's like in that, I don't want to say bandwagon, but I think it is a bandwagon. But I think there's so much to understand, and we use the food system term very, very loosely. But I think it's very, very exciting, and that whole cycle from production to consumption, I think that's what really, really excites me. Also, the fact that, you know, still in the mountains, we do retain our traditional environmental friendly systems. And probably in other places, they may need huge transformation, you know, to get back to a sustainable food system. In the mountains, I think it's more like a revival, because we still do a lot of things traditionally, integrated, family-based, small in size, still biodiversity and, you know, nature positive. So that's what excites me.
Thank you, Dr. Kaling, for walking us through so many various projects and all the exciting stuff happening there. So one of the things that I noticed between all the projects that you named and spoke about is that the human aspect of it is quite important. It's a common thread of sorts, right?
Yes.
So could you explain this interdependence of the well-being of these local communities and conservation of biodiversity?
Okay. So if you take the example of Darjeeling or Sikkim, a lot of times we work around protected areas, okay, and most of them are agriculturists, so a lot of them depend on the forests for every little, let's say I'll talk about very tangible benefits. Of course, there are all those intangible benefits, all of us, and even people as far as where you are in Bangalore, you get some, you know, intangible benefits from nature, from the forest ecosystem, whatever ecosystem, forest ecosystem or aquatic ecosystem or whatever ecosystem. But for people who live close to forests and who depend on the land, and those whose livelihoods are dependent on the land that they, work at. So I think for them, it's more like a tangible benefits. So even for doing any kind of agriculture, they would need their, you know, basic biomass for fertilizers, for manure from the forest, as we know. And then to have those fertilizers, of course, they would need, livestock feed, fodder. So that is also, again, dependent on the forest. Then again, for, as we say in technical language, and I wouldn't want to use that, provisioning services or anything that the forest provides to you. Timber, even to build your shelter, your house, you know, food for the animals. And I think for the mountains and where we live is also a large part of our diets comprise of wild edibles. So these, you know, nutrition-filled wild edibles, mineral-filled wild edibles come seasonally from the forest. And a lot of our communities are directly dependent, not only eating them, but also they sell some of them. So like, you know, things like bamboo shoot, leafy greens, some fruits, some vegetables, anything. So, and the other thing also is a lot of these areas, again, still have the traditional, you know, healthcare systems where you have, you know, a shaman or a local healer. And then again, they are dependent for medicines also from these forests. And it's not that, these people, places are not modernized. Everywhere there's electricity, there's, internet has reached, there's access, they have medical facilities and all that. But even then, the traditional practices are still there. And then for every little culture and rituals and rites, you're still, again, dependent on certain plants, species that come from the forests. So that way, I think communities are very, very much, I mean, it's inextricably linked. Even if they, you know, they don't derive, even if they take the benefits or don't take the benefits, it's also living around, it's also their identity, living in a land which is, you know, surrounded by forests or nature. So it just doesn't fill in your everyday life, like what you consume or what you, you know, produce. But I think also spiritually, culturally, that other kind of well-being, which I think is very, very important and essential for human beings to have a very, you know, a good life. I think much of it comes from nature, and a lot of people are dependent. I think more so the people who live around these really beautiful forest ecosystems or, you know, aquatic ecosystems than us who live a little bit far away. And of course, the intangible benefits are there. They get their water, the fresh air, everything else, you know, the values, the, you know, the recreation values or whatever. So everything else is actually, you know, when you think of it, it's derived from these. So It's really very, very linked. So therefore, I think it's very important when we think of even a species, we can't think of it in isolation. And I think that's the one thing I really like about A-Tree, because we are not talking about just a species biology, or you're not talking about the zoology, but we are talking about, when we say interaction, human interactions, then we are talking, there's socioeconomics, there's economics, there's sociology, there's anthropology, you know, behavior, science, everything, you know, all these disciplines come across and forces us to, you know, think through those lenses also. So I think this it's really connected. And I'm glad that, you know, A-Tree looks at the connectedness of these, you know, different disciplines.
So one of the other key areas of focus of the Northeast Initiative is on formulating policies that is people inclusive. So could you walk us through these efforts a bit more?
Yes. So I think I have to confess that, you know, policy interventions, or, you know, engaging in policy has been one of the biggest challenges for this office through all our, you know, projects or whatever. Most of the time, we try and include a policy, a component in all our projects when we are designing it, you know, right from the proposal stage. So even for this key elements, the one that I told you about, I mentioned earlier, these biodiversity elements in socio-ecological landscapes, we had one whole component on policy. And I think the whole thing about, I think it's quite difficult for us. So where do you, you know, kind of link with policy actually? Where do you engage with policy at the state level, let's say? So at a Sikkim or a Darjeeling level. Because say, for instance, some of these areas which are really rich in biodiversity, in their agriculture landscapes, no? So they have biodiversity, they have a lot of ecosystem services, and these are but agriculture landscapes. So really, we have to look at agriculture policies. But then again, you can't look at agriculture policies alone, because you have to also look at what our water policy says, what our forest and, you know, forest policy or the protected area or whatever, you know, guides our biodiversity conservation. So already, I think we are working in an area or in a condition or situation where most of our sectors are very much in silos kind of a thing, you know. So forest, say, the forest department is only thinking of biodiversity and species and the forest and the habitat, and absolutely nothing about, you know, the other landscapes. Whereas agriculture is only talking about, you know, more productivity, more new hybrids, more disease-free kind of crop varieties. But there is nothing on, you know, biodiversity. And then we have water. Water is something else, you know, a watershed conservation. So, you know, spring shed conservation, but all of them, where do all these three come together? So that has been one of our biggest. So we try and engage through, you know, inviting people, inviting, you know, agriculture department people, any department which looks after our water resources, and we present our work. But then again, the question is, what next? You know, where do you, how do you, you know, come together and, you know, really engage in policy, because we have data, we have the experiences, but where do you go and engage and say that, you know, this needs to change? So we're trying to do that for Sikkim, just the fact that it's smaller, and it's also a state which has been, you know, very famous with its organic mission and all that. So hopefully we can make some dent, but I think that comes much, much after the project is over. So we're still trying. We're trying to, you know, develop some policy recommendations and inputs, and directly dealing with the agriculture department, saying that it's not enough just to declare a state organic, but there are many of these other ecosystems and biodiversity co-benefits, you know, that have to also be discussed. And without them, even the, you know, whatever we've planned as an organic state in doing organic agriculture, that fails, because if you don't have the you know, the services from nature, there is just no point, you know. So that's what we're trying to do. But then definitely Namrata, I think it's one of our biggest challenges, because the way policy is probably made in this country, and then we are far off, you know, in one little corner of the state. So small states, small places. So I think, yeah, that's a challenge, but we are trying our best to do what we can.
So talking of challenges, I'm wondering, Dr. Kaling, that, you know, while focusing on producing agriculture for food security and protecting livelihoods of farmers, how do you, on the other side, also remain sensitive to the needs of the climate? This balancing act must be a challenge also, right?
Well, in a way it is, but I think for mountains, again, where most of the farmers are really like, you know, either small or marginal holders, so we don't have these, you know, huge carbon footprint, a level of, you know, mass production, extensive farming, intensive farming. So if you look at the mountains, they're still, you know, it's very integrated because people have their little kitchen gardens, then they have their homestead gardens, then they have their little production wherever they grow, you know, their maize, they may grow their rice, whatever, they may grow millets, whatever, the cereals. But a lot of them is still intercropped, multi-cropped, you know, at the edges, they'll grow some other things. Then you have a vegetable patch, and then you also have your own agroforestry patch. So that way, you know, it's still very, very integrated. And I think till now, as most of the literature says, majority of the food in this world is produced by small and marginal farmers. And I think that is very true for the mountains because we are still engaged. You know, the farmers here are still engaged in growing food crops. So it is a dichotomy in the sense, like in one way, we are trying to preserve our, you know, traditional food crops, which are supposed to be climate resilient because they are, you know, very, very adapted to the climate over here. But then you have, of course, the, you know, inputs from the agriculture department, which is giving you, you know, high yielding seeds and again, different, you know, exotic crops. And there's more focus on cash crops. So there is this, I don't know, something like a disbalance kind of a thing. Where I feel like, you know, in this changing climate, we do need to grow cash crops because the farmers need them. And in the mountains, it's, you know, it's not a very productive landscape many times. It's a harsh landscape. So you do have only, you cannot just go grow food crops for consumption. That is only for subsistence. But you also need cash, you know, because that is your main occupation, farming. So for cash crops, they do grow cash. You do grow cash crops. But I feel there should be a balance between cash and food because climate change is impacting. And for example, if you look at this entire belt, cardamom, the large cardamom was one of the most important cash crops. And a lot of farmers' livelihoods depended on a large cardamom, right from, if you look at it, in a transboundary landscape like us, right from East Nepal to Darjeeling, Kalimpong, Sikkim, and all the way to the east. I think the large cardamom was very badly affected by some disease. So it was like an economic breakdown for a lot of farmers because their livelihoods depended on that. And then a lot of people, researchers attribute this to the changing climate because of which there was virus and all kinds of different diseases. Because of this happened. So we have to, you know, some kind of an, so we, I think we are facing the brunt of climate change rather than, you know, having a big footprint per se in the mountains or in the areas we work. Rather, we are facing the impact because of some, you know, huge carbon footprints elsewhere. So somebody has contributed to this huge, you know, climate change impact, and little farmers, small farmers in the mountains are now bearing the brunt because definitely climate is changing. And that is mainly through our rainfall patterns, the precipitation patterns, I would say, how rainfall is shifting and how we are getting, you know, very, very long dry spells in winter. So like, I think one of the NGOs over here calculated one year that, you know, we had almost about 3.5 to 4 months of dry spell in winter. So probably sometime it rained last in October. And then I think it rained only sometime in February or something like that. So that's a very long dry spell. And in that period, a lot of farming needs to be done, different kind of crops. So the farmers faced a lot of difficulties. The other brunt of the climate change is also, like, we have these horrible hailstorms when people have their crop in the field. So sometime in March, April, so they occur more often now, and they seem to be more intense. And also during monsoons, we used to have a very regular kind of a monsoon. It's very high rainfall area, but at the same time, monsoons used to be very, very regular. But now it's like, you have these days of no rain and suddenly it pours. So obviously farmers are getting affected, whatever crop is there in the field are getting impacted. So at Atri, what we are trying to do is, how can we make people climate smart in terms of doing their farming? So the things that we do, the training that we do are, how in the winter, how do you, manage your soil moisture that it doesn't get lost? So, cover cropping, mulching, those are some of the things that we do. Then also, using, trying to make your traditional soil microorganisms. So it's almost like, the zero, the zero budget natural farming. So really, when farmers do whatever we have trained them to do, it's absolutely zero cost, because it's absolutely dependent on all the resources. They just have it in their field. So it's use of biomass, some flowers, maybe cow dung a little bit, cow urine most. So, and some leftover rice, maybe some jaggery they have to buy. But everything else is, it's there. So it's really zero budget for them. So how do you manage your soil in winter? How do you, design your terrace that, when you have these horrible downpours, your topsoil is not lost? Then what do you plant at your edges of your field so that, your soil is protected? Also, like, you're doing a lot of multi-cropping, having a diversity of crops in the field. And then in some places, we also try to bring back some crops, especially like mustard, which was supposed to be, quite resilient and which had multiple benefits. So even in terms of agroforestry, we try and work with them to have species that have multiple use. They can be used as fodder, they can be used as timber, or, firewood, or, building material, anything. So I think what we are doing is, telling people to adapt, because this change is happening, but how do we adapt to it? And in that also, providing them a lot of information on the weather forecast through, crowdsourcing data that we have. So we are in a group which, shares a lot of these forecast data, and there's a lot of big, meteorologists there are engineers there. So, and then we take that data and share it with our farmers and say that, you be careful, next 14 days is going to be very, very crucial, critical for your things. So we are teaching them how to, adapt. So again, going back to your question, it's more about, we are bearing the brunt, or we are impacted, rather than, I think, having any footprint per se, carbon footprint per se.
So stepping away from this aspect and focusing on the biodiversity hotspot that the Northeast is, a lot of species still remain undocumented today. So how and what are the efforts going on to do better this, and how can citizens help fill this void?
I think Atri is doing, as one other project, big project is going on, Northeast Bioresources Project, supported by the Department of Biotechnology, Government of India. So a lot of people are already working on plants, and I think there's some work on amphibians and ants and insects and all that. And we on our part are also documenting, so birds, butterflies, mammals, and a lot of work has already been done, at least in Sikkim. The government has also done quite a bit. And if you look at Northeast, I think it's besides Atri, there's a lot of work going on from other organizations, institutions, independent researchers, PhD students, master's students doing their dissertation. So it's not that what it used to be 10, 20 years ago that, Northeast was unexplored. I think there is a lot of explorations, going on already. We may not know, and we may not have coordinated with them, but living here, I know that, there's absolutely a lot of work going on compared to what it used to be. 10, 15 years ago, because I used to also work for the Critical Ecosystem Partnership Fund, and I did a lot of grant making for almost about 70 organizations and individuals in Northeast. So those days, there was very little information. But now I think a lot of information is coming in. And I think, of course, citizens have a very, very important role to play. And I think there's a lot of citizen science activities already going on. We've promoted some. But I think also it's always been there, because there are butterfly enthusiasts, there are bird enthusiasts, so, and also a lot of people from different parts of the country go to those sites, and they find that they have this notion, you know, that it's exciting, Northeast, and also a lot of people are already going. But I think there are some groups like plants, I think lower animals, that we really need to focus on, because I think birds, probably butterflies also a bit, at least in terms of documentation, has been done. Some amount, of course, in herps and amphibians have also been done, but then much lower than, but bats, for example, we've just started working on bats in Darjeeling, Sikkim. And I'm just surprised at how much the British had documented, and we are trying to add on to those lists. So some of these groups, I think we'll have to really, you know, find out and kind of try and concentrate on them. And I think citizens have a big role to play, and we have a lot of experience, because we started working in 2015 on citizen science. And as much as we might, you know, romanticize about it, it's been very, very, it's a challenge. And especially if you want to involve people in the rural areas, from the rural areas, you know, because urban areas, people like you, me, going and doing documentation is perfectly fine, you know, because we have the means to do it, we have the gadgets, and, you know, we have the internet and everything, we can do that. But for the rural areas, we've had a huge problem. And at the same time, we want to take that challenge, and we want to make more citizens, scientists and documenters from these rural areas. Because for them, I think it's their place. The stakes are very, very high for them, should be high for them. And I think, like we always say in the office, like even if you've trained 100 people, and if 10 of them at least also start document and continue to document, that's a big success for us. So even a 10% and less success after these, you know, citizen science training is a big success for us. So there is the digital divide. You know, there are students who are so enthusiastic, but then they don't have Android phones. And then they may have Android phones, then they won't have, you know, internet, you know, coverage or access. Again, these are mountain areas. So, you know, not one point is going to, not everywhere is it going to be uniform, you know, getting internet access. For example, we recently finished, you know, documenting butterflies actually in North Sikkim. So we involved a lot of these young people. People from colleges, people studying engineering, from school kids. And then we had to, at least, you know, in a day, I would always want people to document, but at the same time, upload immediately before they return home. So then we were shifting from 2-3 places, you know, okay, this is a good place. And then we are moving on. No, it's not good over there. So we move multiple places to even upload, you know, one data point. So it is indeed a challenge. So, but I think this office, we are trying more and more to involve rural citizen scientists. Of course, we work because we don't need to work with the urban citizen scientists, because they involve themselves, they organize themselves, and they go and do their documentation. Yeah.
All this sounds so promising, to know that there's so much going on in terms of documenting and, of course, conservation of these species. So what do you think the next couple of years at ATRI Northeast looks like?
Well, I think it looks exciting. Also, it looks very, very challenging. As you know, the government is also looking towards Northeast for a lot of the economic growth. It seems to have, for them, I think it seems to have a lot of the resources that is needed. So for, if you look at energy, or if you look, now recently, if you're looking at the oil palm thing, it's all coming in to the Northeast. It's really a look Northeast kind of a thing, which is good in a way, But at the same time, I just feel a little concerned at the way this, you know, development trajectory is going to take, and you know, what at what cost are we going to, you know, achieve all these that we are saying, whether it be, you know, energy things, so which means hydropower, or for example, infrastructure, linear infrastructure that's being constructed everywhere. I know that it's needed. I know it's very, very essential that we have roads, but you know, how are we building our roads? What are we doing to our natural, you know, ecosystems while building these roads that we need? You know, how are they being handled? What are some of the species that we are losing, species habitats we are losing? And a lot of people say, oh, it's only during these, you know, building up construction phase that these things look really terrible. Once these are constructed, you know, the vegetation comes back, the ecosystem will bounce back. A lot of people argue that, but I feel concerned, you know, we may be losing quite a bit. We won't even know what we've lost. So that concerns me. And the oil palm thing also concerns me. How are we going to do it? Is there a way we can, you know, do it in a sustainable way? I don't know. I have no idea. But I think ATRI will have to play a critical role in that, in the sense, you know, not only pointing out at issues, but also saying, you know, these are some of the solutions probably. And then again, these solutions can't be blanketed. You know, we have to develop these site-specific solutions for these environmental problems. So these are some of the concerns that I have at the larger thing. And the other thing about, I think some of the models we've developed, these may be very, very place-based models. But I think if we do these things in multiple of places, these place-based models can also become, you know, some landscape level models, and maybe, you know, you have lessons at the landscape level. So everything cannot be replicated, should not be replicated like that way in, you know, total 100% replication. Everything cannot be 100% scaled up. It has to have those, you know, context-based nuances and all. But I think ATRI has a very exciting time. We've been here now 25 years. And hopefully going forward, we'll make some more impacts. I think in the 25 years, we've made impacts at least at some village levels. At least when I look at some of the villages we worked in Darjeeling, and when I look at the communities there, when I saw them, because I belong to the landscape, so I saw these villages when I was just a student. I mean, I didn't even know what ATRI was all about. And I look at those villages, I look at the leadership in those communities, I see the bargaining power that they have, the negotiation powers they have. And I really think, oh yes, I think ATRI did do something to, you know, bring these people up or these communities up to what they are now. So I think there are exciting times ahead, but there are also very, very challenging times ahead for us in Northeast India.
Thank you so much, Dr. Keeling. We've reached our end of the episode today. Thank you so much for taking the time and speaking with us today. I look forward to visiting you and the team at Gangtok soon.
Thank you, Namrata. My pleasure. Really, thank you.
Stay tuned to our channel for more insights into the environment and the problems we face globally. Do subscribe to our channel to stay connected.